Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Financial support for victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks is now guaranteed for years to come. Recently passed legislation effectively makes permanent a special compensation fund for first responders and other victims who breathed toxic air for days and weeks following the 2001 attacks. The law provides however much money is needed to pay all eligible claims filed by October 1, 2090. The new legislation will cost nearly $10.2 billion in the coming decade and billions more after that, according to an estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. While 22,400 claims have already been paid, an additional 17,600 remain under review, and another 18,100 are projected to be filed and paid after October 1st of this year, the CBO said. The Senate appears positioned to pass a two-year budget deal that was agreed to by congressional leadership last week. The bipartisan bill would suspend the debt limit until mid-2021 and increase discretionary spending caps by $324 billion over the next two fiscal years alone. The House previously passed the bill last week, and the president is expected to sign the measure. Although largely unpaid for, the budget deal likely avoids a full government shutdown at the end of September or a default on the nation's debt, leaving Congress with the still somewhat daunting task of finalizing appropriations bills. The Senate may get to work on divvying up the 2020 funds as early as this week, which could help get appropriations bills drafted over the August recess and be ready for markup in September. Still, depending on timing, a short-term stopgap funding measure may still be necessary because the next fiscal year is fast approaching, beginning October 1st. Passing all 12 bills individually will be exceedingly difficult. The Senate is likely to use a strategy it has used in recent years, bundling several bills together into larger packages. The House has already finished 10 of its 12 spending bills, but most will likely be rewritten to comply with the new budget deal and gain bipartisan support. Both could spark internal battles over where the money should go. There seems to be little traction on a massive infrastructure spending program in the near term, so supporters of such an effort will likely have to settle for a road reauthorization measure. A committee in the Senate plans to mark up a bill that would commit $287 billion from the Highway Trust Fund over the next 5 years by renewing a surface transportation law set to expire next September. That would result in a nearly 30% increase over current spending levels in the program. It will likely be easier to pass than a larger infrastructure package, but neither party has agreed on how much to spend or how to pay for it. The Supreme Court handed the president at least a temporary victory on border funding by lifting a lower court injunction that blocked some spending. A 5-4 ruling determined that the administration could spend $2.5 billion in Pentagon money on the border while litigation continues. Bipartisan cooperation appears to be occurring in efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions, as both Democrats and Republicans have begun offering legislation that would tax carbon emissions and reduce carbon in American industries. Up next, I'll be joined by Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, to discuss PPI's recently published plan titled A Progressive Budget for Equitable Growth. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. Prior to joining PPI, Ben staffed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings, and he worked on other federal budget issues at BPC, including sequestration, budget process reform, and the federal debt limit. Before that, he was the legislative outreach director for the Concord Coalition, so he's actually one of my former colleagues. He has a master's of public policy analysis and a graduate certificate of public finance from American University. Welcome to Facing the Future, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on Facing the Future. It's nice to reconnect with you. I wanted to talk about a big report or plan that you just put out with PPI. And before we get into the nitty-gritty of the proposal, I'd like to have you give a broader overview of what you're trying to accomplish with this report. What are some of the issues or challenges that you're trying to bring solutions to the table on?
So the report we just put out is called Funding America's Future, and it's a progressive budget for equitable growth. And so the idea behind this budget is that the federal budget is too focused on consumption by the current generation and not enough on investment in the next. Spending on infrastructure, education, and scientific research, which are investments that lay the foundation for long-term economic growth, those investments, as I think we talked about the last time I was on your show, are near the lowest they've been in over 50 years. And at the same time, we've had irresponsible tax cuts and the growing cost of federal health and retirement programs that are feeding trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. We just had, on top of that, a budget deal last week, $320 billion over 2 years, or $1.7 trillion over 10, that was completely unpaid for. So we wanted to show what it would be like to put together a budget that funds these important programs, these public investments, as we call them, but at the same time did so in a fiscally responsible way so that they could be sustainable for the long term.
So, Ben, piggybacking off that a little bit, you mentioned some recent policy endeavors and what you're trying to accomplish. Can you compare this plan to other policy ideas or agendas out there right now?
Yeah. Actually, we developed this plan as part, initially, it was part of a program organized by the Peterson Foundation at their annual fiscal summit. PPI and six other think tanks across the political spectrum put together budget plans, and we compared them to one another at this summit. And so you had plans on the left and the right. Some on the further left than us raised taxes and government spending by an extreme amount. Others had some pretty deep cuts. Our budget was focused on primarily protecting these public investments while at the same time being fiscally sustainable. Our plan is a little bit different than some of the deficit reduction proposals you've been seeing over the past decade or so, back since the Bowles-Simpson Fiscal Commission in 2010, the Bipartisan Policy Center's Debt Reduction Task Force, also known as Domenici-Rivlin. These were plans that really tried to take some existing ideas on the left, existing ideas on the right, put them together, and try to meet in the middle, do something very incrementalist to reduce the debt, with debt reduction being the primary goal. Our budget wasn't an attempt to meet anybody in the middle. We wanted to craft an ambitious blueprint for center-left Democrats, specifically. Obviously, we think it would be great if Republicans wanted to adopt it, too, but I think the most likely adopters are moderate Democrats. We wanted to craft a blueprint that says, what are our values? Our values are that government, when it's focused on doing the right things, can benefit the economy, can benefit people, and how do we make those investments in a way that is smart and fiscally responsible? And so we came at this first with the goal of protecting public investment and finding a way to sustainably finance it. And we didn't limit ourselves to ideas that were in the middle or could get big bipartisan support, were not controversial, So instead, we tried to think outside the box and put out some really new ideas, some that are more ambitious, that maybe are a little more politically difficult, but at the same time would go further in making our federal budget more investment-focused and less consumption-oriented.
Going back to your Concord Coalition days, putting that bipartisan hat back on, how realistic do you think it is that you would eventually get bipartisan support, or that it is an actionable plan? I'm thinking back to very recently the Green New Deal proposal, how it came across as very partisan, or even work on the Affordable Care Act, how you had an entire party or portion of the population that really had no interest in seeing it come into law in full force. In fact, you've seen it sort of chipped away at over the last decade.
I think the ACA is maybe a good example here, because the ACA, in its fundamental architecture, was not terribly partisan. It became partisan because one side wasn't. And this is my view. Obviously, I know you're nonpartisan. We're nonpartisan, but obviously come at it with a little bit of an ideological investment. But the underpinning of the ACA, building a marketplace where everybody could buy affordable health care, is not terribly controversial. It was originally a Heritage Foundation idea. It, its origin was Governor Romney in Massachusetts, and so even though it ended up being partisan, legislative process, the underpinnings were actually taking a lot of good bipartisan ideas. And so, even though we did not design this budget to appeal to Republicans, I think there are certainly some ideas in here that can get some bipartisan support. I've actually already, since putting the plan out, had some interest from a few Republican staffers who will obviously remain nameless, but who found some of our proposals particularly interesting. I think there is possibility for bipartisan action here. It's just that the blueprint is focused with some progressive values in mind.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We're discussing PPI's new budget plan designed for equitable growth. And I want to get back to some of the numbers here, Ben. You mentioned earlier on here that this is in an effort to also address growing budget deficits and the recent trends in the budget in terms of this generational perspective and what we're spending money on. Can you give me an idea of some of the target figures, sort of where we're currently projected to go and where you're trying to get those numbers with this particular plan?
So if you look at where we're on our trajectory, under current law, at least the law as it is written now until the budget deal is passed by the Senate and signed by the President, we are on a path to have federal debt to GDP of roughly 150% come 2050. And so 150% debt to GDP, that means that our national debt will be 1.5 times the size of our economy by 2050. And that's under current law. That's if the law as it is currently written is completely unchanged. But if we're going by current policy, which assumes that today's tax and spending policies are continued, even if they're scheduled to expire as they are under the law as currently written, then the debt will be higher. And the budget deal from last week is a big first step in moving from that current law scenario to current policy. And so under that scenario, we'll have debt that's over 200% of GDP, over double the size of our economy come 2050. PPI's Progressive Budget for Equitable Growth, on the other hand, would put the national debt on a downward trajectory so that by 2050, by growing the economy faster than the debt, we would be able to reduce debt as a share of GDP back to its historical average over the past few decades. I think it's also important to note that our goal isn't necessarily to say the debt needs to come down to that level. Rather, you know, a lot's going to happen over the next 30 years. We want future policymakers to have the fiscal freedom to make decisions for their constituents, to spend resources as needed to meet unforeseen challenges in the future. And so it's not so much that we say you need to get back to this level, as we need to get our budget back on a path to this level so that when the next recession happens or the next national security crisis or natural disasters from climate change, we have the space to deal with those problems instead of running against record high debt and deficits that will create real or perceived constraints that prevent those responses.
And what made you pick the historic average of the national debt as opposed to, say, just maintaining the current ratio, which to many might seem like a more realistic or plausible option?
I think it goes back to that fiscal space argument. I think that ultimately, if 30 years from now we had the exact same debt to GDP ratio we had today, I would call that a huge win. I would say that's fantastic. But I think, you know, again, as we saw with the budget deal and so many other instances since, policymakers are more likely in the future to increase the debt over current projections than to decrease it. We thought it was important to overshoot, to get the debt on a downward trajectory so that we had a plausible shot at just being able to stabilize it in the future. The other element I'll say is that our plan, we made a bunch of assumptions in our plan. So, for example, we assume that all of our policies are adopted by the next administration in time for their first full fiscal year, which is fiscal year 2022. Realistically speaking, we wanted to create a blueprint that gave the next administration the tools they needed so that they could craft their own agenda that at the same time, if it's, you know, roughly in line with what we're recommending, it would still be fiscally sustainable, even if they don't go all the way, whereas if we said, here's our budget, here are the exact specifications, and we barely stabilize the debt, then all of that fiscal space for both the next administration and for future policymakers, that would be consumed right off the bat, and the flexibility just wouldn't be there.
Aside from the fiscal freedom argument, why do you think it's important to address our nation's growing national debt, to address the growing federal budget deficits that we have on an annual basis from a progressive perspective? You know, there almost seems like a growing argument, even in Congress, maybe on both parties, that we don't really need to pay attention to this issue anymore, that it's not necessary as we move forward and make key investments.
So I think it goes back to the Budget Control Act of 2011. I think it is really a great example of how deficits can come back to bite progressive priorities. In 2011, the last time Congress got serious about the need to reduce the national debt, because they couldn't come to an agreement on growing mandatory programs that operate on autopilot like Social Security and Medicare, or tax policy, they compromised on cutting discretionary spending. That's the part of the budget that is annually appropriated by Congress each year. And that spending is divided into two categories, defense and non-defense. And over half of the non-defense category goes to public investments in infrastructure, education, and scientific research. And so when Congress agreed to those cuts, they brought spending on public investments down to these historically low levels. And the recent budget deal was sort of Congress backing off and saying, you know what, we couldn't stomach these cuts, it's time to bring them to an end. But I think if we don't deal with our debts, and if we just do this deal, you know, these two-year at a time deals, then the next time there's concern over the debt, which could come from rising interest rates, a recession, other things that typically spark debt fears, I think there's a very good chance they're going to come back to cutting those public investments first. And our priority with this budget is to say, you know, the first responsibility of the government should be investing in the foundation of the economy and building a better future for young Americans, our children, our children's children. And we need to have sustainable debt and deficits if we're going to be able to protect those investments, not just for 2 years at a time, but over the long term.
And Ben, you have, I think, 7 or 8 different themes in this plan that I want to get into in the next segment. But before we leave this segment, I want to stay on that broad theme just for a few more minutes. And I'm looking at some of the charts that you include with the plan, and one looks incredibly familiar to me. It's the federal revenue versus spending chart that the Conquer Coalition has historically used, showing historical data and then moving to projected data. And it shows me on here that you're expecting, under your plan, revenues to rise to a level well above their 50-year average, and spending to come down closer to its 50-year average. What's driving, or maybe how is it possible to drive revenue that much higher than what we've seen in recent decades?
The way we raise our revenue so much higher is by creating a more efficient, more progressive, and fairer tax system. So we go after a few things right now that are really big problems in our tax code. The first is that we don't have a tax code that is as progressive as it could be. You know, there was that talking point from a few years ago about how Warren Buffett pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary. So we make a number of reforms that make it so we have a truly progressive tax code that makes sure everybody's paying their fair share. And then in line with making everybody pay their fair share, we also go after the tax expenditures, those provisions in the tax code that give tax breaks to certain taxpayers for engaging in behaviors that Congress has said, you know, you do this thing and we'll give you a tax break. These are programs that are effectively spending in the tax code. Some of them are not terribly efficient. We go after the ones that are particularly inefficient, drive consumption over investment, are not terribly progressive, or actually make our tax code regressive. And so by, you know, this fundamental restructuring of the tax code, which we can talk about in a little bit, combined with cutting the tax expenditures, we're able to get higher revenue. The other thing I'll say is 22% of GDP may be higher than we're used to historically in the U.S., but back to that solutions initiative process I talked about earlier with the other think tanks, you know, we had, I think one group went up to 26% of GDP, one group went up to 35% of GDP. So, you know, the policy options are there. It is mathematically possible. We just wanted to make sure we could do it in the most efficient, fair, pro-growth way, and I think that our plan reflects our ability to do that.
And just a couple more quick questions before we go to break. On spending areas, broadly speaking, like discretionary spending and mandatory spending, if you're seeing the long-term cost curve come down in terms of how much is being spent, and by coming down, I mean not continuing to rise uncontrollably, but sort of bending it toward its historic average, where do you see spending on those key areas going? Are they going to be at or above historic averages themselves? Are they going to level out? What do you have sort of mapped out in your plan?
So under our plan, I think the thing to realize is the needs of our society today are fundamentally different than they were over the last 40 years with the retirement of the baby boomers, rising health care costs. These are trends that will make it a necessity to spend more on programs like Social Security and Medicare. And that's not necessarily a bad thing so long as, number one, we have a plan to pay for those programs, and number two, we make sure that the spending doesn't come at the expense of important public investment. So we allow Social Security and Medicare to grow, just not as much as they would under current law. Then on the flip side, we go back to those public investments that have been starred for so long, and we actually increase them. You know, they've right now, for the past few decades, public investment spending has been roughly 1.5% of GDP. But there was a time where it was 2.5% of GDP, as early as the 1980s. And so we would increase public investment spending by a considerable amount of under our budget. I think our increase ends up being in dollar terms 70% over current law projections. And so a big increase in public investment spending under our plan. And we think that that's a reflection of our progressive priorities, where we think the government should be investing going forward.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We've been discussing PPI's new budget plan designed for equitable growth. We'll actually be back with Ben after these short messages, picking up where we left off. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We're picking up where we left off in our previous segment, discussing PPI's new budget plan designed for equitable growth. And I think we spent a fair amount of time, Ben, talking about the plan, sort of generally speaking. And now I want to transition to breaking down and getting a little more detailed on, I think it's like seven themes you have in this particular plan. And we'll start off with the first one, and I believe it's one of your areas of investment. You characterize it as supercharged public investment in social and economic growth. Can you explain to our listeners what that means and maybe how much it'll cost?
Sure. So this is going back to that first point that's sort of the theme of our plan here, and that's reinvigorating public investment in our society. So these are investments in our intellectual capital, scientific research and development, our physical capital, our infrastructure, roads and bridges, waterways, electric grid, and our human capital, education and training for our workers so that they can compete and succeed in next generation jobs. Spending on these programs is considerably lower than it was in the past. It used to be that these programs were about 2.5% of GDP, which in today's dollars would have equaled something like $500 billion in 2018, yet instead we spent just $300 billion on these public investments, 1.5% of GDP. And as we documented in another report last year, Ending America's Public Investment Drought, the cuts to these public investments have had significant negative impacts on the economy over the last few years, and they're only going to get worse if we keep starving these public investments. So the PPI budget says, enough with the starving of public investment. We are going to commit new resources to making sure that these investments are fully funded and that we can have long-lasting, sustainable, widely spread economic growth. So we propose some pretty radical increases in this public investment. So on the R&D side, we propose to triple federal investments in basic research over 10 years. Basic research is research that has scientific benefits long in the future. We can't predict how it will benefit the economy, have market applications today, and so that makes it unlikely that private firms will do this research. It makes up about 7% of private sector R&D spending, whereas it's almost half of federal non-defense R&D spending. We propose to triple basic research investments so that we can lay the foundation for technological innovations that will benefit Americans for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road. And so it's really an investment in technological progress. Then we recommend a $1 trillion infrastructure package. The American Society for Civil Engineers, McKinsey, numerous groups have put out estimates in recent years saying that we have about a $1.5 trillion deficit between what we're projected to spend on infrastructure and what our infrastructure needs are. And so we propose that the federal government fill in $1 trillion of the gap, and then we propose to structure that spending in a way that will leverage the remainder from state and local governments and private industry. And we propose to do that spending in a way that is more efficient and more economically stimulative than the current financing mechanism. And then we propose to adequately fund and restructure our higher ed financing system. A lot of investment in higher ed right now takes the form of tax expenditures that primarily benefit relatively affluent families. We propose to redirect that money into programs that help lower and middle income students. And then we propose some other changes to higher education in the United States that would make it cheaper for students of all income levels to graduate from school. And so I think under our plan, we concluded that we could decrease the average cost of college tuition at a public four-year university in-state by something like two-thirds, which would be an enormous reduction in cost and fantastic for education in the United States.
And Ben, I want to back up just a second to get a point of clarification here. I think in our previous segment, you talked about how this plan would bring forth a 70% increase in investment in some of these key areas. Does that mean a 70% increase in discretionary spending levels broadly, or just some of these very key specific areas?
Just these specific areas. I think that's an important distinction. There are other categories of discretionary spending, defense, and then other non-defense discretionary things like our park service, law enforcement, things that are very important for our society, but that maybe don't need to grow with our economy. And so for defense, we propose some more modest spending levels as a percent of GDP that are roughly halfway between today's spending levels and the target that NATO recommends for all countries. And then On other non-defense discretionary spending, we propose to grow it with population plus inflation growth, which grows at a slower rate than GDP.
And so what are we looking at here broadly? Are we going to see a steady increase in discretionary spending levels, or are there trade-offs taking place, or are you reliant almost entirely on new revenue?
So in the discretionary side, there are some trade-offs, but overall, this budget increases discretionary spending. I think it increases discretionary spending by more than any of the plans that were proposed in the Solutions Initiative, which we view as a feature of the plan, and we think is actually good because it means more fiscal space and fiscal freedom for future policymakers. And so discretionary spending under PPI's budget would be higher both in dollars and as a percent of GDP than it is today. But not all of that money comes from new revenue. Some of it comes from constraining the growth of mandatory spending programs.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We're discussing PPI's new budget plan designed for equitable growth. Spending some time this segment really diving into the details of that plan after talking about it pretty broadly in our prior segment with Ben. Time is catching up with us, so I want to move on to the next sort of theme within the plan, and that is guaranteeing universal access to affordable health care. What do you mean by universal access? Because you could very easily make that sound like universal health care provided by the government. What does your plan propose to do?
So PPI is not in favor of the one-size-government-fits-all, Medicare-for-all approach of putting everybody in a government plan. What we propose is a more innovative market-based solution to get to universal coverage where everybody has access to affordable health care, but it will be affordable health care they can choose. The logic behind Medicare for All is that if you put everybody in one government-run plan, the government has what's called a monopsony power, that the government, by being the only buyer in the health care industry, could negotiate whatever price it wants from providers. And that instinct is not necessarily wrong, but there are a lot of benefits to having multiple different options for health insurance, private health insurance, where competition can result in innovation in terms of financing and management of care that you just wouldn't get in a traditional fee-for-service Medicare system. And so what we propose is let's take the benefits of that. Let's take that monopsony negotiating power for the government, and let's share it with the private sector. So we propose this mechanism called default price healthcare, wherein if a private insurance company can't come to an agreement with a provider on a price for a service, that will default to a price that was negotiated by the government. This will give insurers much more leverage to negotiate lower rates on behalf of their consumers, negotiate more innovative ways of financing care that will be more efficient than the current system, and will really allow everybody to share in the benefits of more affordable health care without having a government takeover and one-size-fits-all insurance. And so we think this approach allows the best of both worlds.
And I'm going to stay on the healthcare theme and talk about the next theme in your plan, which is modernizing Medicare. And it looks like a pretty unique idea, moving the parts of Medicare into something you call Medicare One. What's that look like, and why go that route?
There's a lot of moving parts to Medicare. When somebody enrolls in Medicare, they can choose to enroll in a government-provided plan, or they can enroll in a private plan with a government subsidy. That latter plan is called Medicare Advantage. If you enroll in the government plan, there are three parts to Medicare. There's Part A, which covers hospital visits, Part B, which covers physician services, and Part D, which covers prescription drugs. These three benefits have different copays, different deductibles. One has an annual deductible, so you pay a certain amount out of pocket, and then the insurance kicks in over the course of a year. The other one has a per-illness deductible. So for a specific incident of illness, you pay a certain amount before the insurance kicks in. It's just this convoluted structure with these different interlocking parts. Conversely, if somebody enrolls in Medicare Advantage, they get one consolidated benefit, just like they do from their private insurance when they're working through their employer or through something like Medicaid. So you say, all right, it's time to bring Medicare into the modern era. Let's take the complicated parts of Medicare. If you want to enroll in traditional fee-for-service Medicare, that remains an option, but we're going to consolidate it so that it has one premium, one deductible, one copayment or co-insurance structure, And we create an out-of-pocket cap so that seniors aren't presented with out-of-control costs if they end up with catastrophic medical expenses.
A quick follow-up on that, Ben. Would it be a standalone program, or do you still need a trust fund? Would it still have to borrow from general tax revenue to support the costs within the system?
Well, so that's another element for why we think Medicare One makes more sense than the current system is. In addition to having three different benefit structures, Parts A, B, and D have three different financing structures. One has a trust fund and is funded by the payroll tax. Another has unlimited general revenue subsidies and is partially funded by premiums. We basically say in our plan there should be one financing structure, but we leave it up to policymakers to figure out what that financing structure should be. We make a bunch of changes to the payroll tax, and our basic approach is all the numbers in this budget line up. We give you the revenues, we give you the spending. How you want to allocate and say this revenue source finances this spending program, we leave that up to policymakers. That's a political decision.
I probably had an unrealistic expectation that we could get through a 96-page report within two segments of one show. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to ask for almost lightning round for some of these other remaining themes. And I'll just sort of tee it up for our listeners. You talk about strengthening Social Security, transforming the tax code, expanding clean energy, and empowering workers and families as best as you can, Ben. Let's start with Social Security and work our way down. Give us a quick summary of the efforts you want to see take place within your plan.
Sure, and I think just given your listener base, we should let's focus more on the first two of those four. So on Social Security, we propose what I think is a really innovative approach. To my knowledge, I don't think this has been proposed before, and I've talked to a bunch of experts as we were fleshing out this plan, but what we propose for Social Security is something called a work credit benefit structure. Right now, Social Security benefits are based on your lifetime average earnings, so the more money you earn, the higher your benefit is. The logic behind that when Social Security was created is that it makes Social Security an earned benefit program. It makes people feel like they earned and paid in for their benefits. But it also makes the structure somewhat regressive, because we're paying out higher benefits to the people who need them the least. So we approach this with the question of how do we make Social Security more progressive, more worker-friendly, while at the same time preserving its status as an earned benefit program. And so we created a structure wherein for each additional year of work that somebody works, they get an additional boost to their Social Security benefit. So if a low-skilled worker and his college-educated boss put in the same number of years of hard work, they get the same benefit. At the same time, if somebody works for 10 years on Wall Street, makes bank, and retires early, they're going to get a lower benefit than somebody who works as a janitor for 40 years. And we think that makes a fairer system, but it's also more progressive, and it ends up being less expensive than the current system. And then on top of that, we make a number of other changes to make the benefit structure more equitable. So we propose to allow up to 5 years of work credits for years spent serving as caregivers. That helps reduce gender disparity in the benefit structure that disadvantages women relative to men. We propose stronger benefits for widows and widowers. This is a reform that I took from my days working on the Bipartisan Policy Center's Retirement Commission. Huge problem with old age poverty for widows and widowers. We would resolve that problem in our plan. Additional protections for low-income workers, while at the same time also adjusting the retirement age to index it with longevity. We're an aging society, so people need to work longer just if we're going to keep this system financially sustainable. And then we propose reforms to the cost of living adjustments so that they more accurately reflect inflation, but at the same time, people are more at risk of outliving their savings towards the end of their lives if they have extended lifespans. And so we say after a certain point, we're actually going to increase your cost of living adjustment to account for the fact that you're more likely to outlive your savings. And so these reforms, and I realize we have to go through this very quickly, will create a more equitable Social Security system for both current younger workers and older beneficiaries, and we think it's just a much better way than the current system.
And I'm going to ask one quick follow-up question on that topic before we move on to the tax reforms you're proposing. Is this something you'd have to phase in over time because, for example, the baby boom generation will be already 55 at least by the end of this year? Would you have to phase in this Social Security plan so that you're not maybe negatively impacting baby boomers as they retire?
So, yes, our plan does have a phase-in. We have a phase-in, different elements of the plan phase in at different rates, largely based on equity, how difficult it is for people to adjust to the changes. And these changes start in 2022, the first fiscal year of the next administration, also when the full retirement age will reach the level that it was scheduled to rise to in the 1983 reforms. I also think it's important to note that we're running out of time to fix the problem, and the longer we wait, the less ability we'll have to phase in these changes that preferably would be phased in even over a longer period of time than we recommend. But, you know, because we've been dithering for the last decade, we just don't have that luxury anymore.
And speaking of running out of time, we won't get to a couple of the other themes in the plan, so I would encourage people to go check it out on PPI's website. But before we end here, Ben, can you give us, from a facing the future perspective, we talk a lot about if there's new initiatives on the table, how we're paying for them, what changes need to be made to bring in revenue, if spending is going to go up. So give us a quick rundown of this plan's proposal in terms of tax reform.
So one of the most innovative, bold ideas in here is we propose to get rid of the payroll tax entirely, a massive tax cut for workers. This is a tax that's 15.3% on the first dollar a worker earns, and it's regressive because after a certain point, the tax actually drops down to around 4%. This is used to finance Social Security and Medicare, but you know, as we lay out in the report, we don't think this financing system really makes sense anymore. And especially with our work credit benefit structure, we think it's unnecessary. And so we propose to repeal the payroll tax, massive tax cut for workers, and replace it with taxes on carbon consumption and unearned income. And I just want to take a second to talk about each of those three things. Taxes on carbon. Climate change, this is the last theme of the report, which we're not going to get too far into, but climate change is one of the greatest threats facing America today. It's a global threat, arguably the one threat that is as, if not more, dangerous than the national debt. And likewise, the sooner we grapple with it, the less painful solutions will be. And so we propose to start with a tax on carbon and dedicate a lot of that revenue towards clean energy investment that will, going on with our themes of public investment, R&D, and infrastructure to help grow the economy. So that's one element. Next is a tax on consumption. We propose what we call a dynamic value-added tax. And so this is a value-added tax. They have these in most other developed countries throughout Europe. And it functions a lot like a sales tax of sorts. It's a little more complicated than that. Won't get into that here. But basically, we propose to tax consumption instead of work, which will promote investment. On top of that, our value-added tax is a little bit different in that we suggest that the value-added tax automatically adjusts with the state of the economy, a dynamic value-added tax, to make it a stronger automatic stabilizer in recessions. So economy enters the recession, you can cut the rate by 5%. That means you've automatically cut prices across the board by 5%. That stimulates consumption and helps get the economy out of a recession. And then when the economy is recovered, you raise it back up, and that helps reduce the deficit. And so that's our second main revenue source. And the last thing is unearned income, particularly of people in the top 1%. We think, you know, our tax system is necessary to fund important social services and public investments by the government, but you want to raise taxes in the least disruptive manner possible. And we don't think it makes sense to raise higher taxes on workers or on productive investment when somebody can inherit, right now under the current tax code, $20 million that they didn't work a day in their life for just because of who their parents were, and that would go untaxed. And so we propose to replace the estate tax with a progressive inheritance tax that gets at those unearned incomes. And then other tax changes, such as getting rid of tax expenditures, that result in a more progressive and more efficient tax code. and could go a lot more in depth on those tax reforms, but I realize that we're out of time now.
We are. Again, I'd encourage our listeners to go check out the plan. It's about 96 pages, so it won't be a short read.
Although I'll also just add that our overview, which gives you a quick rundown of the plan, is much shorter. You just read the first few pages, and you can get most of the top line numbers, and then if you're really interested, you can dig in more in particular stuff.
That's true. That's a fair point. It's almost like an executive summary for the paper, which I appreciated for this particular discussion with you, Ben. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Ben Ritz, the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We've been discussing PPI's new budget plan designed for equitable growth. Thank you for joining the show, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.